Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, the cast and crew of the new Enola Holmes movie on Netflix, including yesterday star Himesh Patel and Adolescence director Philip Barantini. We review all the week's new movies, including the unusually named Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie, that has actually nothing to do with Nirvana, the band. You'll have to stay tuned for that. And as always, all the TV you want to stream or skip, you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on the Go Loud app or wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all. I do hope you're doing well. I was unexpectedly off for a couple of weeks there, and a few of you emailed to know if I was coming back. Here I am and raring to go. So let's start with TV, and I have a lot of TV to talk to you about. First of all, I was delighted because this man is back.
Why is this in here? It is illegal to take deep breaths outside.
Well, it should be. You want to see people walking around going, ah, no.
We threw a rod. Get comfortable.
It's going to be a while.
He's got the wrench. No. We got to wait here.
What are
you
talking about?
We got to wait on the plane.
Yeah, what?
We got to wait right here until they fix the mechanical issue.
I got to sit in the middle with shitty snacks?
Yeah.
For 5 hours? Are you crazy?
This is the airplane experience.
It's not a good experience. What a pleasure to be a part of such a historic occasion.
You know what's really irritating about you? You are the world's worst butter churner.
How dare you? Nobody churns butter better than me.
Nobody likes your butter.
Can't wait to get back home to my Daisy. That's what's waiting for me.
Yeah.
Do you not think she's pretty?
Yeah, she's all right. Yeah.
She's all right?
I would take her to the movies if she paid.
Yes, the unmistakable sound of Larry David. And that is him in a new show on HBO Max called Life, Larry, and the Pursuit of Unhappiness. You may be aware, the United States of America, this very day, the 4th of July, is 250 years old. And so say all of us. And Barack Obama is involved in this. And what it is Larry David in history. If you've ever seen the Woody Allen movie Zelig, where this guy shows up in different parts of history, this is Larry David showing up in different parts of America's 250 year history. So for instance, he is in World War One in 1917, refusing to pass on a message from a soldier to his loved one because he doesn't think the loved one in question is pretty enough. We see him in the Wright brothers' plane complaining about having to sit in the middle. We see him at like the signing of the American Constitution complaining about people sharing umbrellas. We see him rather amusingly on a bus with Rosa Parks, and she decides to sit down the back because she's so bored by talking to Larry David. So that's the gist of it. It's all these endless sketches, I guess you call them, with Larry David in and out of history. And it starts with Barack Obama talking about it. And there are some very famous cameos in it as well. Here's the thing though, it's only all right because it's a bit of a gimmick. It's Larry David doing the Larry David of Curb Your Enthusiasm in all these historical sketches, and it just doesn't really work. You're left pining for a new season of Curb Your Enthusiasm. I think this is just too much of a gimmick. And I often invoke my wife in these things because she watches a lot of this stuff with me from the Fardy couch. And reason why I'm mentioning her is because, and this is the truth, I guarantee you, her favourite comedy of all time is Curb Your Enthusiasm. And she was so excited about this and fairly disappointed. I didn't even watch to the end of the first episode. So, and I hate to say this because I worship at the altar of Larry David. I have a lot of time for Barack Obama too. But this didn't really hang together, I'm sorry to say. And I want to give you recommendations. Now, I mean, you know, watching Larry David do anything is always a pleasure. But the whole series, it's just a one note or a one trick pony, I guess. So sorry to say, it's called Life, Larry, and the Pursuit of Unhappiness. Good title. Doesn't really live up to the good title, I'm sorry to say. Something that did surprise me in the land of TV, though, and it was out 2 weeks ago at this stage, but I'm catching my tail somewhat, is the new Harlan Coben show on Netflix called I Will Find You. You may know Harlan Coben is this million, probably billion-selling author of these intricate mysteries, and he did a big deal with Netflix, and we have had a lot of these shows, and I think most people agreed, diminishing returns. They tend to form a pattern. There's this mad story that has all, they're always thrillers, and it has all these rabbit holes and cul-de-sacs and twist upon twist upon twist. And I think it's fair to say people's patience have frayed with them a bit. The good news is I was mostly pleasantly surprised with I Will Find You on Netflix. We have Sam Worthington playing a father who is convicted, not just accused, but convicted of murdering his son and is sent to jail. And when we meet him 5 years later, he's in jail and something goes very awry. And I don't want to give a spoiler, but there is reason to think, or he has reason to think, that maybe his son isn't dead. That's all I'll say. Now, this still has all the Harlan Coben trademarks, twist upon twist. There are some cul-de-sacs in it, but it's better than the recent ones I've seen. One reason, it's set in America, and I was growing tired of the Middle English. As much as I like Richard Armitage, he seemed to be in every one of them. So this is in America, and it's kind of in Boston and New York. And Sam Worthington, in essence, at times it felt like episodes of The Fugitive, or the movie The Fugitive with Harrison Ford, or the TV show from the 60s before that. And it works in that way. So it's quite road movie, but they're on the road a bit. There's a lot of chases in it. So it still has some of the things that might annoy you, but it's better than the recent few I've seen, I have to say. So kind of 3-star review of I Will Find You. Like, it's daft, but I didn't feel as cheated, and I had to keep watching it in a way that I haven't with the last few Harold Coben ones. So I Will Find You isn't bad entertainment for a weekend evening. I don't know what the weather is like where you are, but if it's bad, or even if it's good and you're looking for something to watch tonight, mindless escapism that gets by just about is I Will Find You on Netflix. I also want to talk to you about this.
You do realise this is probably a trap.
Or she could be trying to work it out.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, you're right. This is definitely a trap.
Yeah.
Maybe we could show her that this is a good thing. I like her best friend. And how nice that she already really, really loves the guy I'm dating.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, now that is a clip from Alice and Steve on Disney Plus. And this is, I'd never heard this term, but I do like it, and it fits the bill. A rom-com. It's even hard to say. A rom-com. Not a rom-com, but a rom-com. W-R-O-N-G. And why is it that? Because a rom-com, as far as I understand, is a romance that shouldn't really be, or maybe one people might look down on. So in this, we have Alice and Steve, who are two bosom buddies. Nicola Walker plays Alice, and Jermaine Clement plays Steve. Jermaine Clement, if the name is familiar, is one half of the amazing and hilarious comedy duo Flight of the Conchords. They had their own TV show for a couple of years as well, which is one of the greatest comedies of all time. And in this, Alice and Steve experience a severe rupture in their friendship, because Steve sleeps and begins a relationship with Alice's daughter, Izzy, played brilliantly by the Israeli actress Yali Topel Margalith. He begins this affair. It's a proper romance. It's not an affair, because he's out front with it. And their friendship devolves, him and his former best friend, Alice. This is hilarious, incredibly awkward at times. I mean, incredibly awkward. A friendship that was so close becomes toxic. I really, really like this. It was absolutely hilarious. And Alice's mother in this has one of the funniest lines I've heard in a long time after she finds out about the relationship. And I should mention, Steve and Alice had a very brief thing, like in college, but then they just became friends. But this is what the grandmother says when she finds out Steve has been sleeping with Alice's daughter.
Hiya.
Darling, does that mean that I'm in with the Chalmers too? You could do all three generations. How wonderfully French of you.
Lovely to see you again, Val.
A clip there from Alice and Steve, which is now on Disney Plus, I should say, for your viewing pleasure. And it's absolutely hilarious. I think it's only 6 episodes, or maybe it's 8. Disney Plus, it's terrific. And then finally, because I was off for a couple of weeks, I wanted to mention one thing to you. I have raved to you on this show about Hacks, the series where Gene Smart plays this comedian who's in Vegas, who suffers all these travails, and she befriends a young writer, Ava, played by Hannah Einbender, and they have this glorious friendship that sometimes is full of jealousies and rage, but they ultimately love each other, or they grow to love each other, and it contains multitudes. I've raved about it every episode. It ended a couple of weeks ago. It's on Sky Atlantic, and it was such a delightful ending. Episode 10 of season 5 is definitely up there with one of the great finales of all time. Absolutely bittersweet, absolutely beautiful, and funny. So top 10 finales, to my mind, the final episode of Hacks. If you've never watched Hacks, oh my God, you are in for a treat, because there was 5 seasons of it and they're all great. They got better as it went on and it never lost its mojo. It was perfect from beginning, middle and end, and by God, the finale. You know, people feel cheated often, like with Game of Thrones. Some people felt cheated by the end of The Sopranos. Some people felt cheated by Breaking Bad, even though I don't see how you could. But the finale of Hacks was immense. So do get on Hacks. Let me know what you've been watching. That was a long preamble about all the TV I was watching, but there you go. Screentime@newstalk.com is the email address. Do let me know what you've been watching. After the break, I'm going to be talking to the cast and crew of Enola Holmes 3. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. Now let's go here.
It was glorious.
Good show.
It was fun. When it was neither fun nor glorious. When it was just the two of us. Those were the best times of all. So whilst my life seemed completely uncomplicated, my dear, dear Lord decided to add a slight complication.
Enola Eudoria Holmes, will you take I, Ernest Augustus of the House of Tewkesbury?
Yes, he has a first name. I was surprised too.
Be your husband.
Yes, that is a clip from Enola Holmes 3, which landed on Netflix on Wednesday. Enola Holmes is now a series of movies based on a series of books for young adults. Enola Holmes, the first movie, was out in 2020 and was kind of a huge hit on Netflix after Netflix bought it off Warner and became kind of a lockdown hit, where Millie Bobby Brown plays the titular Enola Holmes. She's the sister of the already famous Victorian era detective Sherlock Holmes. And in the first two movies, she had kind of swashbuckling adventures as this Victorian detective. Her mother was played by Helena Bonham Carter, and they were, you know, jolly hockey sticks and, you know, good old swashbuckling, but they were kind of modern as well. And Millie Bobby Brown is terrific as Enola Holmes. So in the latest one, we find her, as you heard there, on the point of marriage. She's about to marry Tewkesbury, who's played by Louis Partridge, in Malta, of all places, when, as you might expect, lots of stuff happens and she's called away, mostly to do with her brother Sherlock. Without giving a spoiler, he's missing. Sherlock's played by Henry Cavill. And so she's not sure if she's going to get married because of all this that is happening. And swashbuckling ensues. And some interesting things. There's some stuff going on in this as well. It's set in Malta. There's kind of a story here about colonialism as well, which I suppose is unusual for young adult stuff. But this continues in fine swashbuckling form, I have to say. Now, Dr. Watson is in it, and he's an unusual Dr. Watson. He's more subdued than the traditional one. Dr. Watson in this is played by Himesh Patel, great English actor, who was the character, the main character in Richard Curtis's Yesterday. Yes, you know, the guy who sang all the Beatles songs when no one remembered them. And also he was in Tenet. He's a great actor. He plays Dr. Watson. I spoke to him earlier in the week. The interview started a bit weird because there was a door open and he couldn't hear me, but we got it fixed. So here's my chat with Himesh Patel about Enola Holmes 3.
Sorry, John.
No worries. Listen, you got to hear me. It's very important, you
exactly.
know, unadulterated. You
Otherwise,
know?
This isn't going to go very well.
No, exactly. Listen, we first see you on horseback. So I very obvious question. Was that you and did you have to train?
It was not me, sadly. We didn't quite have time enough to get me on a horse. There was a point at which I had to dismount the horse from a from a standing position. And as soon as I mounted the horse, it became very clear that I'd never been on a horse in my life. And suffice to say, when you watch the movie, Dr. Watson is just suddenly off the horse next to the horse.
So that's how
that went. Yeah.
Okay, excellent. It was probably the wrong place to start. You know, I was expecting you to tell me, you know, six months and deep method acting in some riding stables.
Yeah.
You know, what I like about these movies is it really kind of usurps or changes the Sherlock universe. Mm-hmm. You know, Moriarty's very different. Enola Holmes isn't what we expect, even Sherlock. But Dr. Watson it's a strange, unusual, fascinating take on him. You know, we expect him to be very kind of English, but he's something else. I'm not entirely sure. I presume that's part of the appeal of this, that you're mixing up something that's so kind of traditionally well-known and English, I suppose, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I would argue that he's still English, but
it doesn't seem kind of hockey sticks and jolly Savile Row suits, kind of, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You're talking to an Irish person, so maybe I'm dealing in cliches here. You know?
I hear you. Yeah, I think that was kind of what I was interested about when we first discussed it back in, I think, 2021, when I shot my cameo at the end of Enola Holmes 2.
Yeah.
I spoke with Jack Thorne at the time and just sort of discussed what their ideas were at that stage, if they were to do, you know, a third movie and that Dr. Watson would be involved. And we had this rough outline of doing this version of Watson that was tied into ideas of colonialism and, mm-hmm. and, you know, the impact that colonialism can have, which speaks to a sort of a modern context. And I suppose that's what's wonderful about these movies, is that they are sort of a reflection of the modern world, as a lot of movies are. But there was a real opportunity here with this period of time to explore something that hasn't really been explored before. And that really excited me.
I was talking to Philip, your director, before this, and, you know, they're swashbuckling and entertainment, but they are of the now, and there's this Afghan thing going on without giving too much away, and Maltese colonialism, and even Enola's, you know, sense of being a woman and marriage and her own kind of thing. I mean, that must really light your fire as an actor, that it's on one level swashbuckling and yet all these things going on.
Yeah, I think that's what I found really special about the first two movies, was that they're both about something underneath, you know, everything else. And to manage to be so entertaining, funny, moving amongst all of that is a real feat, you know. Speaks to the great writing, of course, that we come to expect from Jack Thorne.
Sure.
But, of course, you know, Harry did a great job with the first two movies, and I think Philip's come in and really taken it by the reins, and it's grown up in a sense without losing any of the sense of the joy and the fun that we have from the first two. It leans even further into that slight darkness at the edge of things.
I know it probably often comes up a lot, but as a Beatles nut, I can't get over how good you were singing those songs.
Thank you.
In Yesterday. It's a good while ago now. It seems like only yesterday, if you'll pardon the pun. It's actually a good while ago.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
But, you know, you must have had some Beatles fans are obsessive, and I know what I'm speaking about. You must have, and you did a great job, and I'm sure you know you're a good singer, but there must have been some trepidation that you're going to sing in a movie like Yesterday and Hey Jude and stuff like that.
There was, yeah. But they gave me enough time to prepare.
Okay.
I had a good few months there from being cast to us rolling, about 2.5-3 months. Where I just sort of sat in a room and learned all the songs. And so when it came down to it, you know, I felt pretty well prepared. And obviously you keep rehearsing and practicing as you go along based on the schedule and what's coming up when. And we kept tweaking the arrangement of the songs and all that sort of stuff. So it was ever evolving. But I felt really well supported, and I think that had a lot to do with it, yeah.
Tell me this, if Wikipedia is to be believed, I just had a quick glance this morning, it says that you did a paper round until you were 19. Is that true? And would you recommend everyone stay doing paper rounds up to the age of 19?
Well, it was actually 21.
Wow.
Yeah, so would I recommend it? On one level, no. On one level, probably having a more thriving social life in an urban setting is a bit better. But I certainly look back on it more fondly than I felt it at the time.
Okay.
But, you know, I was living at home with my parents whilst I was still, you know, on EastEnders, which is where my career started.
Yeah.
And it was the one thing they asked of me. You know, they didn't ask anything else of me while I was staying at home, but they were like, we would appreciate your help.
Yeah.
I've been doing it since I was a sort of 13, 14 year old. So it was just sort of continuation for me. It wasn't like anything new.
Okay. Yeah.
So, yeah. But it certainly kept me grounded. You know, yeah. It stopped me from getting ideas above my station. yeah.
You know, it's funny you mention EastEnders. I was going to mention, these are name drops, but everyone I've spoken to over the years, from like George Clooney to Angela Bassett, they always talk about their days on, I guess they're called soap operas, as this terrific grounding, and that everything's nearly easier after it.
Right.
Because it's, do you share that? I mean, you don't have to, but I always, and even Danny Dyer I spoke to once, he's saying like, you get these pages, they have to be done. There's no messing around. And, and then you appear on other sets and it's kind of like, this is a cakewalk compared to EastEnders or Holby City or whatever.
I think so. There is a lot of truth in that. In that just the volume of material that you're covering. Of course, there are other demands to other forms of screen acting. You know, I've been lucky enough to work at a huge scale, you know, where the pressure is on just because, you know, you've got only so many takes to get something because the light's fading or all the sort of other variables that aren't necessarily present when you're shooting a soap. But then having that grounding in the volume of stuff that needs to get done. So being able to just switch, to flick a switch, to get into, you know, character, get into whatever you need to do on that day. Maybe that did have a lot to do with why I find it comparatively easier. Because I'm kind of used to that pressure.
Well, listen, you're handling it very well. So continued success. And sure, maybe I'll talk to you on the next one. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thanks.
Cheers.
Thanks for bearing with us as well there.
Not at all. Yes, Himesh Patel there, thanking me for my patience. Most importantly, he was talking to me about Enola Holmes 3, where he plays Dr. Watson. Now, very interestingly, Enola Holmes 3 was directed by Philip Barantini, who was on this show last year because he directed Adolescence. Yes, that era-defining show with Stephen Graham and Owen Cooper, all about social media, knife crime. It was a huge show last year. He previously gave us Boiling Point. So I was surprised that he was directing Enola Holmes, as I spoke to him about earlier in the week. Hi, Philip. John Fardy from News Talk Radio in Ireland. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm good. I spoke to you last year for Adolescence.
I remember,
You humorously threatened to cut the interview when I told you I was an Everton fan.
Yeah, I did. So yeah, actually, let's do that now as well.
It's nice to see you again.
Yeah, you
too. But listen, on that, so when I got news of a couple of interviews for this, I said, yeah, absolutely. My kids and I loved Enola Holmes. And they were saying under the director. And I was going, what? Your man from really? And so I suppose, you know, the last thing I saw of yours was Adolescence. And now here you are in this, you know, rip yarning tale of this young detective related. It seems very incongruous, but I guess that's from the outside looking in. But for you, I guess it isn't.
Well, to be honest with you, like, I had a similar reaction when I first got asked if I wanted to do this. And, you know, before I'd read the script, my initial thought was like, why have they come to me? Like, what, you know, I'm not, it's not my track record. You know, but when I read the script, and obviously Jack had written the script, Jack Thorne, who wrote Adolescence. I was surprised actually by how sort of dark it was at times. And also like the time has passed. So Enola's now a grown woman. You know, and she, and so it sort of lent itself to be that slightly more grown up and a bit darker. So I sort of pitched to legendary, like, you know, I could put my spin on it a little bit and make it that way. And also that it's moved to Malta, so it's slightly different to the other two movies, you know, in that respect. So I was really intrigued by it and excited, actually, because another reason and one of the main reasons, I always like to challenge myself in everything I do.
Sure.
And I think, you know, having such a big big movie, you know, to be able to play with was interesting to me. Also, my daughter is 9 years old, right? Oh, okay. She can't watch anything that I've done. She's a big fan of Enola Holmes and the franchise, like you were saying, and we'd watch them together as well. So
yeah,
I just had this excited feeling about, like, I get to make something that she can watch, and also it's different and it's fun and it's a challenge. It's a huge challenge for me, you know, to be able to do something so different. And I just threw myself into it, you know?
Yeah. I don't want to be reductive about it, saying it's rip yarning and all that, which it is. And it's jolly ho-ho and English and all that. Absolutely. In a good way. But there are themes there, I was thinking. Like, there's obviously colonialism and the whole Malta thing. But I suppose even, you know, the whole series, you know, I don't want to call it feminist, you know, but it's about a woman kind of usurping the male order in some way. So I assume all that stuff appeals to you, given all you've done before.
Yeah, absolutely. A million percent. And actually, you know, the other two movies, she's a kid and she's very reliant on her brother, Sherlock, and all of the people around her, mostly men, actually, apart from her mum, who is not really around. So, you know, in this movie, she's now a woman. Sherlock's not around. He's been kidnapped. So it is a story of, like, this independence and you know, finding yourself. Also finding yourself, she's been offered this, you know, she's been offered to be married to a lord, to become a lady, and, you know, she doesn't want that. Does she want that? Yeah. Doesn't she want that? So she's got this internal push and pull, and you know, that really did speak to me in this movie.
Yeah, sure. Millie Bobby Brown, I actually spoke to her last year for another Netflix movie called Electric State. Just a little name drop for you, you know, it always helps things. Yeah. But she really is terrific in this. And it's one of those roles where you can't imagine anyone else being Enola Holmes. Like, she's, I don't say typecast now, but she is Enola Holmes. Here we are in the third movie. I mean, what was it? I mean, of course you're going to say it was great work and murder, but I wonder, does she seems to me she probably has that molecule changing quality that great actors and actresses have.
She does. And actually, you know, when I first met Millie, one of my first pitches to her was, look, you are Enola Holmes. I don't want to come in here and change anything. You know the character better than anybody. She brought the books to Legendary, you know what I mean? The Nancy Springer book. So she is Enola Holmes, right? And so that's what I first wanted to say when I first met her. It's like, I don't want to come in and change anything in that respect. Yeah. So, you know, it was so important to me that. But she's amazing. She's incredible. She's such a wonderful human being. She's an amazing actress to work with. She's very easy. And she's also a fantastic producer. She knows what she wants. She'll do anything to get it, you know.
Yeah. Listen, continuing the name dropping, but there's a point to this. So last year on this show, I spoke to you guys along with the cast and Owen and Stephen and Jack, and also on this show I spoke to George Clooney, Angelina Jolie.
Oh, come on.
And Robert De Niro. All last year, right? Shameless
name. Who was your favorite?
Hear me out. Well, we'll get into that in a minute. But it was a thrill to talk to Robert De Niro, as I'm sure you can appreciate.
Yeah.
But, right, of all those shows, my people came to me and showed me the statistics of the podcast downloads and listens. And the highest show out of all those had been a certain figure. But the episode of Adolescence that I did in this show was double that, and the highest it's ever been in the 7 years I've been presenting this show. So that's a very long name-droppy way of me saying to you, like, that show has gone interstellar in terms of where it's traveled, it seems to me. Like, in the minute or two we have left, looking back now, I know you made it probably 2 and 3 years ago, but it's a year since it all happened. Mm. Why do you think it happened the way it did?
It's a good question. I think we just hit the zeitgeist, and it was like, it was something that was screaming out to happen, especially for parents and, you know, and a lot of people who you know, have young boys and girls who are, you know, in this world of social media, and we don't know what they're up to, essentially.
Yeah.
So I think we just hit it at the right time. And, you know, the power of Netflix as well, they just get it right and hit the right spots. And honestly, it's been a wild ride, but like,
I can imagine.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I've been reading that everyone from Steven Spielberg and people like that are fans, which just must be,
I mean, you know, Steven Spielberg is my actual idol, and like to get to meet him and for him to say to me, how did you do it?
Yeah.
Was like, sorry, what? You're asking me how I did my thing, is like, that's just stupid, isn't it? It's ridiculous.
Yeah, that's a good day when that happens. And finally, and a world away from it all, the World Cup is on. Are you hopeful that it's coming home and all other such cliches?
Who knows? I'm actually going to the game tomorrow, but here I'm in New York, so currently I'm shooting something here. But
yeah,
who knows? It's just, I don't know. I'm not a massive.
Can you not tell me if you're going to win the World Cup? I thought you'd be able to tell me about it.
I can tell, yeah. I'll tell you off camera.
And then very finally, what are you doing next? Because I'm fascinated by what you've done so far. Is there, what's next on the horizon?
Well, I'm currently we've got 2 weeks left in production on a TV show called Rabbit Rabbits, which is another Netflix thing with Adam Driver and Will Poulter, Regina Hall and Odessa Young. And it's very different. Again, it's a tense thriller all set in one location, pretty much. And yeah, it's been a lot of fun. I've directed all 7 episodes. So you've got bags under my eyes, that's why, you know. But yeah, it's fun. And then who knows what's next? There's a couple of things floating around that I'm, you know, debating on which one to do next.
Okay, wonderful. Great. It's lovely to see you again and to talk to you. And hope I'll talk to you on the next one. Cheers, man.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks. Good to see you.
Philip Barantini there, talking to me about all sorts of things, but ostensibly about directing Enola Holmes 3, as well as his amazing series, Adolescence. Now, one of the big characters in Enola Holmes 3 is Moriarty. And in this, and we saw her in Enola Holmes 2, but in 3 she gets a much bigger part. And Moriarty, you know, Sherlock and indeed Enola Holmes' sworn enemy, is a woman in this series of movies, played by a great English actress called Sharon Duncan Brewster, who was years ago in Bad Girls, but she's been in everything from Star Wars to Dune. A terrific actress and a lovely lady too. And I had a chat with her about playing Moriarty in Enola Holmes 3.
Hello, John. I'm great. It's gorgeous to be able to speak to you today about the film. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Are you in London?
No, and we're not. We're currently in New York City. We're on the island of Manhattan, making it work, looking over at Central Park. It's beautiful here.
If Carlsberg did Jobs or something like that, you know. Listen.
Yes.
Sorry. I'm making small talk here.
It's all good.
your Moriarty is, it seems to me, she's terrific, but she's pure evil. There's no redeeming qualities about her. Is that fair to say, do you think?
There's no mercy. And why not? And I think, you know, I'm a really nice, humble, quiet human being, really. So it's all performative. So don't worry about that. But yes, she's got bite. She has a dark energy about her. And I think that Moriarty always has had a dark energy. I think that there are so many different people that have played Moriarty. Choices go from all sorts of, you know, all sorts of angles. But yes, in this particular part 3 of Enola Holmes, we decided to really go dark, because I think, as we've seen Enola go from part 1 and 2, she's grown up and she's entering realms where, you know, she has to make some really difficult choices and cutthroat situations. And so, we had to make this thing believable, that this is not some sort of fairy tale like world where she gets a little tap or a knock here. She's in a place where it's fight or flight. So, That's what we went in. And Phil Barantini, our director, has always been absolutely 100% adamant that it has to be believable and realistic. And I think that's why they got him in, to have a tougher edge, to bring some fresh, darker energy to the storytelling. And as you've seen, it's dark.
But I guess that's fun. You mentioned you're a nice person, which I assume you are.
I really am.
I've no doubt. But it must be great as an actress to get someone who's so measly evil, which is what you've said anyway. Like that's what you long for. Tell me this. I was talking to Phil earlier.
Yeah.
And Netflix won't mind me mentioning this. Did you watch Adolescence like everyone else?
Do you know what? I'm going to tell you, I held out for so long because I'm the sort of person when there's a hype about something, I don't want to step on. I tried to stay away from all the spoilers because I just wanted to take my own time to watch it. So I knew I was going to be working with Phil, and then I said, look, before you start the job, you better watch the show, because there's nothing worse than working with somebody and you don't have anything to talk about. And so I did. And yeah, it's one of those pieces of storytelling that I believe people are going to be talking about it for years, for decades. It's an outstanding, especially for me, number one, with the technicality of everything that went on with how it was shot. Amazing, absolutely amazing for everyone involved.
The funny thing is, you seem far too young, but you were in a show back in 1999 that was kind of...
Don't expose me there, please.
No, but I was actually watching a clip of you singing Amazing Grace this morning in Bad Girls.
Bad Girls,
that's the first one that comes up. But it's just, you mentioned Adolescence. Like Bad Girls, looking back on it now... You know, that was very ahead of its time. There was a lot of stuff in that show that we hadn't seen on TV before.
Yes.
I mean, you were a young actress at the time. You're still young, but you know, you were new Fresh. Enough to the gig. Did you have a sense at the time that, wow, this is heavy stuff we're doing here?
Do you know something? I've been so fortunate enough to work on a lot of projects that were groundbreaking. The thing about Bad Girls being a female prison drama set in the UK, there had been ones in Australia.
And
Prisoner Cell Block H. There are sort of these periods of time where these shows come. Orange is the New Black came sort of these gaps of 20 years between. But all of them having the guts to tell the story from the female perspective about women and how vastly different we are and the different issues that we encounter on a daily basis and how difficult it can be to navigate through life. And Bad Girls was one of those shows where it actually did have a sort of younger audience to begin with. They also grew into, you know, huge fans. It went for a very long time. I think it ran for something like nine years, okay. I think. But there are still people that I meet on the street who talk about how much that changed their lives because of the subject matter and how they felt strongly they felt to go in and really delve into these stories. So
you know, another life-changing thing for lots of people is Star Wars. I was one of those.
Yes.
I just wonder, whenever anyone's been in Star Wars, I can't just help but ask him about that. But, you know, you're in something like Bad Girls, which is celebrated and all that, but it's a small kind of crew, I imagine. Like the Star Wars machine on Rogue One, is it? It must be phenomenal and weird and wacky and crazy.
My first day of filming on that, I was actually brought in for reshoots. They'd already done two sets of reshoots, and I came in to do the third round, and I was pinching myself because I'd gone from doing a rehearsal around a table with just about seven people, gone back, got changed, came out, and it was just everybody. And that's when it hit me that the machine that, as you say, which is the Star Wars franchise, was just, and I grew up watching these characters. I was gobsmacked for a good 5 minutes. I couldn't speak. I literally could not speak because...
Which isn't great as an actor, I suppose.
No, and I started the scene as well, which was the issue. But I was just so astounded by everything, cameras, set, costume. I went, oh my gosh, this really is Star Wars, because we'd heard so many rumors about this Rogue One and what it was going to be like. But when you see it, you go, that is... definitely Star Wars. So,
yeah.
And I feel so fortunate and lucky enough to have been
so
able
you
to
should.
Do that.
And then very finally, I read this morning there was a teacher in what we call secondary school who you kind of credit, who gave you the acting bug. Is that right? After school...
Oh, it was an after school, the Anna Shear, the Anna Shear Children's Theatre, which was in North London, Islington. She was a drama teacher of sorts who you'd go to a club. It was sort of like a hall that children from six and a half years above could go and do some improvisation. And she has borne the careers and artistry and all sorts of empathy. Psychiatrists, nurses, doctors, but presenters, producers, singers, songwriters, we've all gone through Anna, who was one of the most beautiful individuals I've ever met. She instilled such confidence in us. And I would say to you right now, if it wasn't for Anna Shear, I would not be sitting, I'm actually getting emotional, I would not be sitting here talking to you. So she was great, great human being.
Well, God bless her and God bless you.
Thank you. Thank you.
And continue to
And she was Irish too. So, yeah, you can't go wrong.
She's an Irish person.
Thank you so much,
nice
darling.
To see you.
Lovely to
Cheers.
Meet you too.
Take
care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Sharon Duncan Brewster there, talking to me about her early mentor, but also playing Moriarty in Enola Holmes 3. And I should say Enola Holmes 3 is now on Netflix for your viewing pleasure. If you like the first two, you will definitely like this one as well. Up next, Chris Wasser has the week's new movie releases. And there's a fascinating one called Nirvana, the Band, the Show, the Movie. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. We turn to the week's new cinema releases. We were talking about a Netflix movie before the break, but we are now firmly in cinemas. And a very intriguing, wonderfully bizarre movie called Nirvana, the Band, the Show, the Movie, which has nothing whatsoever, or very, 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 very little to do with Nirvana, which we're going to talk about, and also a movie called My Father's Island. Delighted to be joined by regular reviewer on this show, Chris Wasser. Chris, hello.
John, hello. How are you?
Not too bad. So listen, Nirvana, the Band, the Show, the Movie, an unwieldy title. I have seen this wonderfully bizarre movie. I'm kind of spoiling it because I thought it was wonderful and I have a feeling you did too. But tell our listeners what this is about. It's kind of a hard one to explain. So I'm glad you're going to do it, not me.
I'm going to do my very best, but I've noticed that a couple of things happen when you mention the title of this movie to different people. One is that they think they've missed out on this documentary about Nirvana, the band, as in Kurt Cobain's Nirvana, the one and only Nirvana. And that is completely understandable. If you've never heard of Canadian Jokers, Matt Johnson, Jay McCarroll before, you are instantly going to think this is a Nirvana film. The second is that when you actually describe the plot of this film or what the plot of Nirvana, the band, the web series, and then the television series was all about, they'll look at you like you've lost your marbles. And again, that is fair enough, because this is such a very difficult thing to talk about with someone who hasn't actually seen it. But, you know, as far
you
back
better
as
give it a go.
16, I think it was about 16 or 17 years ago, you had Matt Johnson, Jay McCarroll, two filmmakers, two jokers, comedians, podcasters, and all the rest of it, coming together to create first this web series, which ran for a couple of seasons, and then a television series, which repeated the idea. The idea being that Matt Johnson and Jay McCarroll were playing fictionalized versions of themselves, who started a band, this useless musical duo who hadn't ever, you know, written a song before. One of them can play the piano and is very good at the piano and is very good at coming up with, you know, little tunes here and there, but nothing complete. But these two absolute chancers who are desperate to play a gig at Toronto's famous Rivoli Bar. And that is the hook for the entire series. Mm. That they just go out of their way, like one of them comes up with a different scheme every week to try and land a gig at this famous bar. You know, if I was to transport it to Dublin, it'd be like a couple of Dublin, you know, buskers coming up with a million different ways to play a gig at Whelan's. But the one thing that they never actually do is contact the venue. So they're always coming up with stunts and gimmicks. So this lasted for a couple of seasons online. It lasted for a couple of seasons on television. At one point, Matt Johnson and Jay McCarroll, who both have, you know, very successful careers. One of them as a filmmaker, he made Blackberry last year, which was a critical and award season success. The other is a film composer. They've both worked together on the forthcoming Anthony Bourdain biopic. They've come together to do something that they've been teasing Nirvana, the band, the show fans for years. Oh, that's the other thing that I forgot to mention, John. Sorry. They call themselves Nirvana, the band.
Yeah,
as if the joke wasn't weird enough.
It's very strange. And also, I should say, the Toronto Canadian aspect is a big part of their appeal, because the movie in particular is rooted in Toronto, and the CN Tower and the Sky Dome and all feature very large in this.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing about the series is that it's always followed this guerrilla style shoot where the guys are running around Toronto, you know, playing pranks, doing everything they can to get a gig, and involving, you know, unsuspecting members of the public. So while you're watching the series, a lot of the time you might have been thinking to yourselves, how did they make this thing? Well, that's just amplified with this film, because they've put together this film which throws in one additional bonkers ingredient, and that is time travel.
So one of them
came up with this idea halfway, you know, through developing a script. What if we parodied other films? And then that developed into, what if we parody just one particular film, and that's Back to the Future. So it's Back to the Future with a very, very, very small budget. Again, you've got this guerrilla style shoot. The film was shot over 6 months, you know, often without permits, often where the lads got themselves into trouble. And it basically imagines this scenario in which the two boys are coming up with more schemes to try and land a gig at the Rivoli. And somewhere along the way, one of them accidentally turns their tour RV into a time machine. And they end up back in 2008, which, of course, for fans of Nirvana, the band, the show, is where this, you know, joke all started.
Yeah. And also, and we don't want to give, I mean, it's not really a spoiler laden movie, but there is a narrative motif there about different realities or different futures that might have been. Right. So that's a pretty good description of it. I'm sure people are still quite lost, but that might be the point of it. Now, I thought this was hilarious, crazy, really didn't know what I was watching for a while, but had a big smile on my face for most of it. Were you the same?
Oh, absolutely. It is so goofy, and it's so aware of its goofiness, but it's never, somehow the joke never gets annoying. I found this thing, you know, the same with the series, just completely irresistible. And you keep thinking to yourself, there's only so many schemes here that, you know, Matt can come up with, that, you know, before the whole thing gets a little bit tiresome. It doesn't. Instead, I spent, instead of asking myself, when will this joke grow old? I was asking myself while watching it, John, how did they do this? How did they get away with this? Because there are scenes in this film that I cannot explain. I mean, there's one stunt where the boys arrange this skydive off the CN Tower in Toronto into the Sky Dome below, but the roof comes over the Sky Dome before they get a chance to land on the pitch. And I'm watching it, and I read about how it was shot, and I still can't explain it. I don't know how they did it. There's another where they're connecting a cable from the top of the Sky Tower down onto the ground, which is then wheelbarrowed to, you know, an electrical mains on the streets of Toronto. And I'm looking at it going, this looks real. This looks, and you've got people standing around in the street who are unwittingly helping out with the plot of the story, because there's a screenplay, but an awful lot of the dialogue here between the boys and then obviously between, you know, members of the public was completely improvised. So I can't explain that. And I also can't explain, I mean, it's sort of seamless when they do get to 2008 and they start running into themselves, and you've got like wonderful little homages to Back to the Future in terms of, you know, the main characters trying to avoid running into themselves and, you know, causing a tear in the universe, basically. All of that stuff, again, it's done by, I think, maybe splicing the new footage with old footage, also throwing in additional dialogues that the whole thing kind of makes some sort of sense. It's sort of seamless, isn't it? I mean, I was watching this thinking, this is so well done. For guys with, like, you know, very little money to work with, very little, you know, few resources to work with, they've created something that's quite polished, quite accomplished.
Like. Yeah, for something that's guerrilla filmmaking, like there's one scene in particular where a future character is talking to his old self, and it's done brilliantly. And it's, as you say, very clever, like, I don't know, Hitchcockian filmmaking. Tell me this, like, for people who don't know these two guys, and I was barely aware of them, it seems to me, though, this is fine. This is a freestanding thing, which will take you on a ride, whether you've heard of them or not, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so listeners might be thinking, okay, so fans of this obscure cult Canadian comedy music series might appreciate this film, but I won't. Yes, you will. You will pick up on what's going on within the first 5 minutes, and you will grow to love these characters within the first 20 minutes. By the time it's over, you might even be crying out for a sequel. This is very much open to newcomers. And I think that was important. I think maybe that was, you know, in terms of using the footage from 2008 and introducing, it's almost like the film introduces the characters again. So that's how it is open to newcomers. And that I'd say that was definitely, you know, at the front of their minds when they were making this thing. But it's very accessible, very, very funny, endlessly inventive, definitely loopy. But again, I think it knows it is. And there's also this sense with the guys that it's almost as if they can't believe that they're getting away with this, but they are. And it's one of the funniest comedies I think you'll see in cinemas this summer.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know what? Like, you know, often, you know, a web series turning into a movie, you're kind of watching from behind your hands going, oh, you know, some things belong on the web, two guys in a basement or two girls, but this found a life on the big screen. So hats off to them. So Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie is in cinemas from this Friday, which is the 3rd of July. What would you say stars wise, Chris?
I loved it, John. And you know what else you were talking about there in terms of, you know, web series or television series turning into movies? Some of the first thing that a lot of these shows do when they're going to the big screen is they take the characters on holiday. And I'm very glad that they haven't done that, because there was a plan, I think, originally for the guys to, you know, land a tour instead of landing a gig at, you know, their beloved Rivoli Bar in Toronto. So I'm really glad that they didn't do that. Instead of taking them on tour, they've taken them through time. It's very, very clever. It's definitely worth your time this week. I'm going to go with 4.5 stars out of 5.
Right. Okay. I'd go 4, which is nearly 4.5, but I'll go 4. But certainly one of the funniest things I've seen in a long time. We are talking about Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie, which bizarrely has nothing to do with Nirvana, as in the Kurt Cobain band. But this is a great movie. Let's take a flavor.
This is sounding very like safe, non-swearing rap from the 80s. And I'm up there with a mic teaching people the alphabet. You got your A, your B, your C, your D, E, F, and don't forget G.
If you want to learn the alphabet, here's what you get. You get A, B, C.
A clip there, a very funny clip, I hope you'll agree, of Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie, which is in cinemas from this Friday. Caution advised, once again, it has nothing to do with the band Nirvana, but don't let that put you off, because Chris Wasser gave it 4.5 stars. I gave it 4. Something very different, which I haven't seen, Chris, is My Father's Island in cinemas also from this Friday, about a son and a father in the wilderness.
Pretty much, yeah. You have this story about a depressed father and his frightened child battling the elements and also one another. And it's from a French filmmaker named Vladimir de Fontenay, and also based on a novella which was part of a wider series of semi-autobiographical stories by this author, David Vann. Now, as I understand it, the books, the setting in the books was Alaska, but it's all been actually transported in the films, or at least, this standalone film to the Norwegian fjords. So you have the dad, Tom, played by Swan Arlaud, a wonderful French actor. Tom has been out of the picture for years, doesn't know his teenage son Roy at all. Roy, played by a young actor named Woody Norman. So Roy has been living in the UK with his mom Elizabeth, played by Tuppence Middleton, and they sort of have their own thing going on where, you know, as I say, dad is not around. So you can imagine their surprise when Tom just suddenly, you know, calls the house one day and says that he has a plan. He wants to meet with Elizabeth, and he wants to talk about what we think at first is going to be a summer trip, but it's something a little bit bigger than that. He wants Roy to come and live with him for the best part of a year on this remote island in the Norwegian fjords. So they'll have the place entirely to themselves. They'll, you know, stock up for the winter. They have this, you know, he has this one friend who will fly in and out with supplies if they need it. They'll communicate with her through, you know, a two-way radio, but that's it. They won't have much in the way of, you know, communication with the outside world. They won't have their phones. So it'll just be the two of them. So Roy, he's excited. The mom is a little bit worried, but Roy is excited because he's never, you know, he's never really got to spend much time with his dad, and this will give him a chance to, you know, reconnect, to get to know one another. His dad can, you know, teach him how to hunt and fish and all the rest of it. But the other thing that he's never experienced is his father's mood swings. And there's a reason why, you know, mum and dad separated, and there's a reason why mum has been a little bit cautious about, you know, dad spending a bit more time with them. So he's going to have to, you know, get used to that if they are going to spend all this time together. And he's also going to have to get used to wild bears occasionally trashing the house. And the thing that he begins to realize is he doesn't realize actually what's worse, the wild bears or his father's temper.
Okay, okay. Right, so, you know, it's not a bad premise, father and son bonding in the wilderness with a dissolute father who's depressed. Is there a thriller element to this? Did I sense that from the trailer?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, it's a little bit of a slow burner. Once we get into, you know, once Dave actually spends, Tom and Roy, a bit more time in the cabin, and once they realize, there comes a point where Tom realizes Dad hasn't really fully prepared for this, okay. In terms of how we're going to store the food, in terms of how we're going to prepare, you know, protect ourselves from bears. I mean, Roy was told at one point there won't be bears, there definitely is. there comes a point where Roy becomes frightened, you know, how are we going to survive through this harsh winter? And that's where the thriller aspect comes into it. Okay. But I actually enjoyed potentially the moments before that, the quieter scenes where, you know, this father and son are just sitting around, you know, asking one another questions, just getting to know one another because they've never had that chance before. It's the quieter moments that I really enjoyed. And I think Swan Arlod and Woody Norman, there's a couple of brilliant performances there. Arlod is excellent. I think Norman is definitely an actor to watch. You know, he's had some big roles before, but he's still very much on the rise. And I think the performers here definitely fulfill their ends of the bargain. And also the cinematographer, it's a beautiful looking film and a beautifully scored film too. So there's very much elements of this thing that I really liked. But I do think the film as a whole, it's a big but, John. I do think the film as a whole promises one story and then delivers another. Because the story is, it's full of holes. And I don't want to say too much because this is a story that's constantly changing gears and that won't let us in. And there comes a point where you realize why that is. And there's something that happens towards the end of this film that completely pulls the rug from under us. People who've read David Vann's stories will know exactly what I'm talking about. If you have never read the story, then you will be surprised as I am. And there's a narrative swerve here that I just thought was undeserved. And I don't think the film earns it. And I think it's a little too sly and it kind of cheats us a little bit. So as much as I enjoyed the performances and where I thought the film was going to go, I thought where it actually ended up and the story as a whole was quite exasperating.
Ah, okay. Now, Swan Arlod, of course, he was in Anatomy of a Fall. Very good in that. Tuppence Middleton, the unusually named Tuppence Middleton. She probably doesn't have much to do in this, does she?
No, she doesn't. I mean, we see her, you know, in the cafe at the beginning, meeting with the dad and kind of him and Han about whether she should, you know, let her son join him. And it's the same goes for any other, you know, there's actors around the sidelines. There's flash forwards to scenes of an older Roy revisiting the cabin. But all those parts of the story, they don't really have much time to breathe. It's all about Swan Arlod and Woody Norman reconnecting out in the wilderness. And as I say, I think they do a wonderful job together. I think Swan Arlod is a very powerful actor who doesn't have to say much to, you know, get your attention. And Woody Norman, who is the head off of a younger Harry Styles in this, he's the performer who he reminded me of most in this film. You know, he does some quality work too, but I just think that they're let down by this story that's kind of a bit too choppy. It's kind of jumping around the place. But as I said, I don't want to give anything away, but there's a reason for that. And when you find out what that reason is, you do feel very cheated.
Okay. So My Father's Island was going along swimmingly in the Norwegian frost and ice and snow and then took a narrative swerve. So where does that leave us stars-wise?
I think I'm all about the half stars this week, John, but I think I'm going to go with 2.5 stars out of 5. Okay. But what I will say is those two performers are brilliant. And this is a filmmaker who for a while at least looks as if he knows what he's doing. Give it a go, but just if you are going to watch it, don't read anything about it in advance and see how surprised you are. Because as I say, the film goes places that it wasn't expecting it to. And I'd be interested to, I'd say it'd be an interesting film to talk about rather than.
Well, we've just done that. So I better watch this as well and reconvene with you. I mentioned Tuppence Middleton. I once did an interview with her and it wasn't her fault, but she did it from the back of a moving taxi on a phone. So that's my long-standing memory of Tuppence Middleton. However, more importantly, My Father's Island, which is also in cinemas from this Friday, gets 2.5 stars from Chris Wasser. Chris, thanks as always.
Thanks, John.
Chris Wasser there reviewing the week's new movie releases. And Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie, God, that's a hard title, is terrific because I've seen that as well. My Father's Island, Chris said, not as good, but I am interested to see it. That is it for this week. Next week on the show, I'm going to be talking to the great Jennifer Garner about a new show she has coming out on Sky and Now TV called Five Star Weekend. That's all to come next week. In the meantime, if you want to get in touch with me, you can send an email, screentime@newstalk.com. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on the Go Loud app or wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, it's on the radio every every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Now, I want to finish with a very special piece of music. We often play some music from the movies or the TV at the end of the show. I want to play this for the most loyal listener this show has ever had, and that is my mother, Julianne Fardy, who sadly passed away a couple of weeks ago, hence my absence for the last few weeks. There is nothing to say when you lose a parent, but I will quote the great Denzel Washington, who said, "A son's first love is his mother, and a mother's last love is her son's." And that was certainly true in our case. So I'm going to leave you with a song. I'm not sure if it's from the movies or a TV show. I'm sure it probably is. But my mother was a massive Elvis fan. So I'm going to leave you with "You Were Always on My Mind" by The King, especially for the Queen, Julianne Fardy, and wish you a happy remainder to your weekend.
Maybe I didn't treat you quite as good as I should have. Maybe I didn't love you quite as often as I could have. Little things I should have said and done, I just never took the time. You were always on